Other thoughts?
This is Peter. Just kind of a perspective on process here, because these other suggested modifications have not yet been discussed at the steering committee level, and so we're not quite sure how the steering committee is going to come down on these. But I do think it's important to at least spend a short amount of time on them and offer the long-term care facility perspective, if you will.
Well, let's stay with this then, Peter, if you don't mind, because it caught my attention as well. And even though it may not fit right here with just this one activity, this first one, A, it does come up over and over again in terms of the disability to the patient. It's a very different kind of disability that is imposed upon the patient versus the surgical hospital patient that you expect to recover. These nursing home patients are starting at a different baseline.
Right.
Randy, anything to add?
Oh, not really. I think, keeping in mind our patient population, what seemingly would be a relatively minor complication, I think as you were getting at to a younger patient, may produce a month or more of loss of function that they may or may not ever recover.
Right, and the functional disability that our patients have, usually if an event occurs, they don't recover to that former level anyway.
Eric, this is Jim. I'm almost thinking about the word additional disability because so many of them have serious disabilities at baseline.
Right.
And I think someone could argue, well, they're already seriously disabled. What's the big deal if they are further disabled?
Okay. Hey, let me ask, Stefan, did you join the call?
No.
Okay. All right. Gloria, anything else to add?
No, I was just thinking. I like the word additional disability as a modification consideration.
All right. And Laura, anything from you?
No, I agree with that.
All right. Then let's take a look at number 11B. I think this has I think it has particular resonance.
Mm-hmm.
Particular resonance. And it has to do with bad training and using a crowbar instead of a hammer and putting equipment to use for purposes other than what they're intended.
Would this include, we later talk about restraints, but would this include the use of sheets as a restraint? Or, I mean, how, because that's frequently used and has resulted in strangulations, for example.
Well, I think the purpose is to bring things like that up right now.
Yeah.
That in and of itself, bringing it up as part of the discussion is important. Other thoughts?
Okay, where?
Well, it seemed to be.
I think we see it fairly frequently where certain things are used not as they were originally intended at all, but because perhaps somebody doesn't have anything else, and so they think, oh, I'll do this instead. It's fairly common, so I think it's an important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Eric, this is Jim. I'm thinking about unambiguous from the standpoint of what our medical standards and what our community standards. For example, the excellent example of the sheet used as a restraint, I think we all just kind of gag when we hear that, yet there are some places, some facilities, where that is considered standard of care. So we'd have to be thoughtful about the ambiguity.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I guess the point that I'm questioning is are we considering a sheet, for example, or, you know, a towel, or, you know, anything that is at their hands, are we considering that a quote, device, which is, you know, regulated by the FDA? So how broad do we broaden this, you know, our discussion of a device?
I think right now we leave it that we've identified these ambiguous issues.
Uh-huh.
And again, you know, it's the National Quality Forum, but this is the stuff that gets right to the issues of safety.
Right.
Yeah, I think.
Sorry.
Go ahead. No. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking about when I look at the includes but is not limited to the catheters, drains, and others. I mean, just in that group alone, it opens up wide in the nursing home where the wrong pump is being used for a tube feeding, or you know, Foley catheters are being used for G tubes, and you know, we've just done so many different kinds of things.
Forget about that one.
You're not condoning that just because of the environment and the lack of equipment, are you?
No, not at all. I'm saying that it's so. It's so prevalent.
It's so pervasive that you're
so pervasive.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Well, and Melinda can perhaps correct me if I'm wrong because of the historical involvement for her here, but this was mostly oriented to, you know, devices and different types of catheters, et cetera, as you would think about them in terms of manufacturers or FDA approved, et cetera, et cetera. But your points are very well made, and if there is this prevalence of maladaption of all of these things out there, then it certainly is important that this group identifies that, we highlight it up, we get it into the deliberations, and we look for ways to get it into the language that comes out.
Exactly. And I do think that we take it all the way to where we almost started this, our towels restrictive devices, our sheets restrictive devices.
But doesn't that go under the restraint category? These are more devices.
Well, we might, but it's still not a bad idea to highlight the uniqueness of this environment and perhaps the creativity.
Yep. Ropes. I mean, they could use anything.
That's going on here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because of limited resources.
Eric, this is Randy. Are there two separate issues that's being addressed here? The SRE defines death or disability associated with the use or function of a device in patient care in which the device is used or functions other than intended. So this encompasses the improper use and also maybe the improper maintenance of a device so that it's not functioning properly.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree.
Mm-hmm. But I think this one pretty clearly is pointed towards medical devices, not sheets used as restraints.
Well, and then again, if the outcome is that our deliberations end up being that the language is written to exclude that, that's okay. That's just fine. But it's a rich discussion nonetheless.
I do like the point that was just made about the issue of improper maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall if that's... there was some language about that when talking about electric shock, so I don't know if
we'll get to that too.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so, but it may come up in this section too as well.
All right. Peter, you had another comment here or no?
No, I'm good.
All right, let's go on to the next. All right, talk to me about air embolism. Jim?
Yes. Boy, I think getting to, no question it's serious, but ambiguous in terms of how would we even diagnose that short of an autopsy in long-term care?
Other comments, other thoughts, central lines in the nursing home?
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going was, I just had a resident that was admitted that had a TPN, and you know, we have so many central lines now. I agree with Jim. I mean, the diagnosis is an issue, but the risk is there.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Agreed. I mean, I'm agreeing with people that I think it'd be hard to diagnose this, but we do have increasing use of central lines.
And unlike the hospitals, I don't think the nursing homes have implemented any of the bundle packages yet at all.
Right.
I think this is applicable because we do, I mean, even though it hasn't been discussed and nurses may not even know how to assess for, you know, what the symptoms are of an air embolism are or whatever, it can occur anywhere within insertion, maintenance, or removal of it. So, you know, it's still applicable to this setting.
And don't you think if you're going to play, then you better be able to pay?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the story. We may be putting procedures in place and not looking at the consequences at all.
Well, and I think, too, since in many nursing homes, this is a relatively, these central lines historically are relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you get into that relatively new situation, you've got a huge problem with education and training.
Yes.
And those kinds of things.
Oh.
So, I'd say this is applicable.
Well, my own facility won't get into this because we don't do them frequently enough, and it's not worth the cost of training up.
Mm-hmm.
But other facilities do them frequently.
Oh, yeah.
That's the game they're in.
Right.
So I think this does fit.
Yeah.
Lindsay, any comment?
I have a comment. This is Laura.
Please.
When discussing, I don't know if this will be a separate list that will go out to this setting, but to give examples, like in the list of serious reportable events table that I'm looking at from that the NQF published, it talks about vaginal delivery, spinal instrumentation. I mean, those kinds of examples aren't applicable to our setting. So will, as we're talking about all of this, will guidance be provided to this setting to where they can understand that, you know, they are using central venous catheters and so then, you know, providing good examples for how this could be applicable to their setting.
Peter, my understanding is that this is a separate product line. Is that right?
Maybe they dropped off. They've been having trouble.
Boy, they are having trouble.
I'm back on. Peter may have been dropped.
Okay. Lindsay, the question was when the SREs for skilled care are published, will they stand alone as a product line of their own, or will they be with all of the other SREs that may or may not be applicable?
At this point, the thought is that they'll all be in the same report, but they'll be listed separately.
So that you can identify that it is applicable versus it's not applicable.
Yes.
Okay. And Peter,
so are we going to collect then? Is it important for us to collect or contribute when the applicability ideas around when it's applicable, like our discussion right now on central lines?
Yes, we are looking for some of that information for the implementation guidance and the specifications of the event.
Mm-hmm. And I think the discussion does just that.
Right.
Right. Peter, did you make it back on?
I'm back on. I apologize. I was just talking with the operator. Apparently, both Lindsay and I are dropping off intermittently for some reason. So,
well, we're pressing on.
We do.
We're pressing on.
Yeah, I'll. I may take a few moments off here and try and work with our IT folks to see if there's a line problem on our side, since it's only Lindsay and I who are dropping off, and we're on the same main line.
All right.
But go ahead, please.
I think we've got this particularly answered. Now, are there any other nuances that we want to discuss before we go on? Only that we've identified that this is, in fact, a growth area in skilled nursing. All right, let's take the next one then. These are patient protection events now that we're looking at. Lindsay, can you move us up?
I think I did.
Well, it's 15. You want to bring it to the top of the page?
Are you looking for infant discharge to the wrong person?
Yes.
That is showing on the top of my page.
Yep. Not anymore.
Screen sharing mode, Lindsay.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Well, everybody has the spreadsheet. You can have that at the bottom of your computer and push it up.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing anyway.
That's what I'm doing too.
The line.
I could see better that way. Do you guys get a discount for using this?
And we are actually in full disclosure and transparency. We're about a month into a new system.
Oh, okay.
Both on the phones as well as on the web stuff, and we're not too happy just yet.
All right. So infant discharge to the wrong person. We do have skilled facilities that take care of kids.
Yeah.
I don't know how low the age goes on some of these.
This is under 1 year.
That is correct. No, this is under 1 year. I'm saying I don't know of these pediatric facilities to what age they will, how young they will take patients.
Okay.
Well, the real meat of this, though, this is Randy, is though in the suggested modifications of changing it from any minor to any person unable to make decisions, which is the majority of our residents,
right.
And then changing wrong person to unauthorized person, which means basically anybody who isn't either I'm not sure whether guardian or at what level you'd make an authorized person.
So you would say that this would be a good SRE with the change in the language to minor.
I'm saying there may be some unintended consequences that we'd have to really vet out on this one.
No, wait. All right, well, tell me more. I mean, it would be applicable if it said minor, would it not?
Yeah.
It would be applicable if it says any person unable to make a decision.
Yeah, limited decision-making capacity.
I'd have both. I put both minor and any person unable to make decisions.
So maybe this is maybe we're actually suggesting a significant change to the title of this.
Right.
To make it useful. Because
we have a minor 16 that could make decisions. I mean, even though not in a legal capacity, or they could be they could be emancipated. But I think minor would be a good thing still to have, and then a person unable to make decisions.
As a second, a separate event?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. And that's fine because.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking this is dividable into two events. One, the infant or minors, and one, more applicable to our setting, which is the person unable to make decisions.
And it's very interesting. I tend not to like to clump or make similarities between pediatric patients and our elderly patients.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you look at the SREs and some of the definitions, especially here's one example, and then, again, we'll get to fall sooner rather than later. There are similarities. I mean, you have to think of them in the same kind of limited capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So your suggestion here is to go with the minor, but then completely discuss as a separate category, if at all possible, a patient that is impaired and incapable of understanding.
Yeah, this, Peter, the origins of this were the newborn infant abductions.
Right, exactly.
And that's still obviously a horrible thing, but the train of your thought and where you're headed, I think, is very relevant and would be well received by us.
Yeah, and in fact, that can happen.
Yep.
Oh, it's a serious issue. People who are trying to financially abuse elder patients. But again, I would fully support making a separate and totally new related to long-term care facilities a reportable event of just this. But again, back to the definitions, you're going to have to very tightly define a person unable to make decisions.
Yeah.
And also, who is an authorized or an unauthorized person. That may well depend upon state law.
Correct.
Stella, very worthwhile discussion here. Any other thoughts?
Well, from a process vantage, this is new territory for us as NQF, and we, wrote the cover memo that you all got late last week about should new SREs come up in discussion, then we still need to fill out all of the background information and all of that sort of stuff. I think you're very much on the right track. I think this is an important topic. We'll just have to decide how we might want to process this as a, is it a modification, is it an addendum, or is it an entirely new SRE?
Right, and you're in new territory deciding how they get promulgated, put forward.
Yeah. So,
do we have any issues with preventability on something like this? On an issue like this, I'm just thinking about, like, you know, an older adult in a long-term care facility and the family coming and taking them away, or, you know, somebody coming in and taking them away. Where does the staff of the nursing home, where are they held responsible for something like that?
Well, and I think, there's the situation where the family takes them without checking them out, without signing them out, and nobody knows. There's that kind of an issue. And the other issue is, when you're looking at unauthorized persons, I just had a situation last week where a family had come down to visit a relative. They weren't on the list as being authorized. It's, you know, it gets very complicated because the person who's on the list as authorized was unavailable, out of the country. There's just all kinds of things. So I think, you know, I really like doing something around this, but I think there are some issues around the implementation guidance, the preventability, and as I think Jim mentioned earlier, concerns around the whatever the state regulations
are. Yeah, with regards to the competency, right, exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Eric, this is Jim. One about a political statement about linking an elder reportable event to an infant's reportable death. Just the political thought around infantilizing elders.
Yeah, we got to be very cautious about that.
Right. But we would get around that by making it a separate.
Two separate.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. That's why I like the separate.
Yes. All right, pretty strong suggestion here. All right, let's take a look at elopement number 17. I have no problems with this.
Me either.
We have teaching case after teaching case of elopement, and I think this is one where the facilities are actually geared up. This would not surprise them one bit.
I can, from our national survey that we conducted with adverse event reporting, looking at both the state level and the nursing home level, they're really good about reporting abuses, elopements, suicide, but you know they fail on these other areas that we're talking about. So, I'm not surprised that this one would make it to the list because it's already being done.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
What about the discussion of how many hours or where they're found? I mean, if they're on the property or off the property and all of those issues, because I would think they would need to be off the property.
What if they fell down a stairwell and weren't found?
Yeah. Wandered onto the grounds and were behind a bush.
Froze to death.
Yeah.
The freezing to death is the one that happens, right?
Within sight.
Locked themselves in the closet and died, I've seen.
Or within sight on the property would not be an elopement. Some states consider that an elopement if they see them on the front porch and as long as they get past the front doors.
Well, but this is capturing death or serious disability, too, not just an elopement.
Well, this first one is just looking at elopement, though.
And it says it has disappearance in parentheses. I don't know if that satisfies your question at all.
But it does say patient death or serious disability, so it's not just the fact that they eloped, but something happened, correct?
Yeah, elopement itself may be a problem from the state regulatory agency, but I don't think, in terms of this SRE, I think it has to involve a death or serious disability.
Yeah.
And then no problem.
Yeah.
And you do have competent elders who would like to take walks, who go out in their assistive devices or their, I've forgotten the names of those motorized vehicles that they can use, who are, you know, in their own home are free to go take a walk or a ride in the neighborhood. You just have to be thoughtful about how you define elopement. If somebody who is perfectly competent legally and able to make decisions decides to go take a walk and gets run over by a car, is that an elopement?
And would this then be an elopement, I mean, typically what I see mostly in the nursing homes is that they ask the residents to sign themselves out. So if they've signed themselves out, it wouldn't be an elopement. Jim, most of those residents that you're just talking about would sign themselves out, don't you think?
Yes, that's a very good point, Deb.
Yeah, and I think this issue is getting at, you know, a lack in the care process that's occurring. So, you know, they haven't assessed for their risk of wandering, or they've left the door open. You know, there's a breakdown in the care process that's occurred.
My guess is that there's plenty of state language on this process as well that NQF can use, but this shouldn't be much of a difficulty.
Right.
Let's take a look at the next one, the attempted suicides. It happens.
Definitely.
And we did a small study that showed that people in assisted living and in long-term care have very limited resource to commit suicide, and water is one of the ways they do it. So... is there anything we want to add here, or just pull it right over to skilled? Looks pretty straightforward, huh?
Yeah.
All right, Lindsay, you're still with us?
I am.
Now I have to worry. I'm sorry. I'm going to worry about you guys now because I'm never sure you're still on. So pardon me for the – I'll probably be checking back with you more frequently with regards to that. Peter, anything you want to add to this?
I just – you guys are doing great. You've got good momentum going. But if you wanted to take a short break, I'd open that up for you guys. But it's entirely your call.
I was actually planning to go through the existing ones right to the next level where we have where we do have a change in agenda and take our break then. Is that okay, or do people want a break right now?
I'm okay going.
I'm okay.
All right, let's
Derek,
keep.
Derek?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Let me go back to the elopement one. I want to make sure that we're not talking about patients or residents that have the permission to be off the premises. But something happens to them while they're off. They're competent individuals that have the authority to go out, and then something happens to them while they're out, and then I want to go back and look at that.
Right.
Well, I think we had that discussion to the extent that we were talking about that if they're competent, most homes have some kind of mechanism for them to sign themselves out of the out.
But sometimes they don't, and they go and come as they please if they're competent individuals. That can happen. I just want to make sure that that's not going to be an issue for the reportability here, that it happens off premises when they have the authority to leave.
I think we need to go back or reconfirm what the definition of elopement is. But if I find somebody that's coming and going because they're capable of coming and going, I don't consider that elopement at all.
Right. I just want to make clear that that's going to be
right. Exactly. Good. That's good.
Yeah. Because we know that people go down to the store and then something happens to them and they have the authority to do that. I just want to make sure that definition captures that would not be reportable because that would be happening off premises and they would have the authority to be off premises.
You elope in Rolla, Missouri, and you're likely to get eaten by a bear or something.
I drive through that town a lot.
It could happen.
All right, let's move on, please. All right, we are at medication error. Is that where we are supposed to be? Yes.
Care management. Yeah.
21. Yeah, care management. Okay, so we're at 21 now. Patient death associated with medication error, and maybe this is the most common we see.
Yes.
Yep. Speaky.
Anything else you want to add to this? There's quite a literature base on this as well.
Mm-hmm.
The only question I have, Eric, is about
there are patients in our facilities, as you well know, that self-administer drugs and use over-the-counters drugs that they have may have been brought in by a family member, even themselves. How does that fit into this?
Well, we have to decide how it fits in, okay?
Was there any discussion when the hospitals made up this list about that? Because I'm sure patients bring in their own medications from there as well.
Yeah, it's Peter. I don't know the honest answer to that. There hasn't been any current discussion about this, but I think it what was just asked, and I think it's important that you guys talk about it because it is highly prevalent now. And I'm sure it will come into the hospital discussion as well.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties is that the language doesn't help us here because even if it's over the counter, many of the facilities require the prescription for it or the physician or prescriber's okay that they can take it themselves.
Yeah, this is the real issue or is the situation where no one has any idea. I mean, I'm sure all of us have been in that situation where you open the drawer, the resident opens the drawer, and there's all of these drugs there that you didn't even know.
Or the family brings them in.
Or the family brings them in and they don't tell anybody. But I'm looking at the language under the implementation guide where it says this event is not intended to capture. And then it's got some things around patient death or serious disability, but I guess it really raises. I mean, in theory, you know, you could put something in there that says that reasonably that the staff would reasonably be aware of. But on the other hand, are we being vigilant enough about this issue?
Well,
it is a problem.
It gets to the point of medication reconciliation on admission, too. So is that part of the care process?
Well, it goes beyond that as well. Now that we've got so many, now that, you know, the movement is patient-centered,
right?
We're allowing for more of this. We're allowing for more risk to be involved because the presumption is that the patient and their family are assessing some of that additional risk for the benefits of autonomy.
Right. And culture change, and they're going to see more of that.
Well, as originally written, this SRE predates medication reconciliation as a phenomenon. But I think the points that were just made a moment ago is relevant. So how do we make this more meaty and important for this environment?
Yeah, well, I think we're beyond even medication reconciliation now because the piece that's there is the autonomy piece. You know, the equation is now autonomy versus safety.
So, but for me, I'm thinking you're absolutely right, Eric, but given that, given the autonomy piece, given the fact that residents, do we have processes in place where we're asking those questions, and is it the responsibility of the staff to ask those questions so that we have some kind of an ongoing mechanism to make sure we know what residents are taking?
You bet.
So I think we need that kind of language to be in here.
Agreed. Any other thoughts and comments?
Again, on the other side, there will be events where they're going to be bringing in medications and that even though the staff is asked, they are not going to be aware of it. And so there needs to be we need to put something under not intended to capture where there is medications being dispensed or delivered by the family or the resident without staff knowledge, even though there's been an effort to find out. So I think that needs to be included.
So as this discussion continues, this will be a difficult concept to remain unambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
Eric, comment I have on it. You know, this category probably in our setting, one of the biggest, if not the biggest issue is around Coumadin. And excessive anticoagulation or lack of anticoagulation. And a lot of times that involves drug interactions, and I know that it does say includes administration of medication with a known allergy or drug-drug interactions, which there's known potential for death or disability. But there's a lot around Coumadin that has to do with that could have to do with the patient's own medications that are being brought in, that they with unknown interactions, et cetera. And also it's the issue of failure to monitor that gets into did the doctor fail to write for INRs, and suddenly you've got a INR of over 10 and the patient has a spontaneous bleed intracranially or something.
And we've had that happen.
I've consulted on
cases.
Where this has happened.
And methotrexate deaths as well.
But it's just a big category, and I think I'm not sure that the language was capturing what, you know, one of the most problematic areas.
Agreed.
Yeah, I think we can all agree this is hugely important and well worth any time to modify it to make it unambiguous, but it is a huge issue.
And in fact, we might want to, at first, Peter, stay away from some of the self-medications. Not that they're unimportant, but this issue is so critical to the nursing home, just at the upper levels,
right,
that you don't even need to get into some of those other things.
Well, maybe a path here is to, you know, try to refine or make some suggestions for refining the language to make it less ambiguous. And maybe there's a recommendation of a footnote or something that these other issues need to be addressed,
could that
about
go
self-medication, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Could that go in? So, looking at this area where under the implementation guide, this event is not intended to capture. Can it go in there with,
sure,
with the caveat, though, that it needs to be addressed at a later time under a different event or something?
Yeah, what we may we'll see how all of the recommendations and inputs from the TAPS and steering committee comes along. One of the strategies that we have done with the safe practices is that we have these implementation guidelines, and then we have a separate section in the report, areas for future research and development.
Let me throw this out. I know Coumadin is a huge problem, and I agree with that, and one of the biggest things we see, but also just medications and just lab values that go with medications. So even if you're doing an adjustment of a medication, like even antibiotic or a thyroid, or that can cause serious events because you're not doing the lab monitoring or the monitoring that you need. And I think monitoring was discussed before, so that's a whole issue with the medications.
I think that's going to get brought up when we talk about the new guide. The new ones, because that was one of the items that was in the list, was failure to follow up on test results.
It's also one that's covered fairly well right now in the state operations manual with the responsibility on the pharmacist.
Also, I was going to, Eric, as Randy again, I was going to comment, we could take a page from the SOM definition of unnecessary medication too, because in addition, in the definition of the SRE, it leaves out that one part that they put in, which is a drug that is not being properly monitored.
So, Peter and Lindsay, we are talking about the State Operations Manual, the Bible that the consultant pharmacist at the facility uses, and there, with regards to medication and its management and appropriate laboratory monitoring, there is a lot now that's been written that are responsibilities within the facility.
Okay. All right.
Very good. Anything else here? All right, let's take a look at 22. All right, patient death or serious disability with a hemolytic reaction. We are providing blood products in the nursing home, no doubt. Thoughts or comments?
Should we be?
We don't, but I think sure some people do. We don't, but.
Yeah.
I guess a question here, this is Jim, is in something that is episodic around the country but not a generally accepted procedure done in long-term care, should we address this, or should we say it only happens at such a low frequency
that we should not address it at this time.
Well, let's ask the question, is there data that would say that this is an event that occurs enough to be monitored?
Yeah, I have no data to get a sense of it, only personal experience.
Right. And this may be one of those that was pattern bombed to be included in skilled care.
Is there any way we can get this information from, like, the OSCR or any of the large administrative databases that we could see how many homes are actually performing blood transfusion?
I think, isn't there something in MDS that's captured around blood products?
Well, does that say whether they're going out to an outpatient center to get it done or whether it's inpatient?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it just says, are they receiving them?
Yeah.
Just as a general comment, being in the big providers, I just know that this is not something that they're doing. I'm not saying that there isn't a center in the country that doesn't do this, but I know for the big providers that this is not something that we're doing.
Well, this may just not then raise to the level where it needed to be considered. We could go back to whoever requested it included in skilled care to give us a rationale.
I like that.
Peter, is that okay?
Well, you know, it is an existing serious reportable event, and if there are some facilities that are transfusing, then those facilities should probably be held accountable for this. If facilities are not doing transfusions, then it's not relevant to those particular facilities.
Right.
Yeah, that actually makes sense. I mean, we certainly would want facilities, if they're going to take on that process,
to be accountable.
To be accountable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Eric, this is Jim. Let me follow up on someone's comment about some patients receive blood products within the facility, but a lot more leave the facility.
Right.
So as far as the accountability piece, who is responsible for reporting that event? Is it the center, the transfusion center offsite, or is it the facility where the patient lives?
Well, most of these SREs are site-specific. I mean, that's their intent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this group is not clear at what the scope of the problem might be in skilled facilities.
As I see the actual submission, it did not request skilled nursing facilities to be included on this.
Yeah, I just looked at that too. I see that.
All right. Enough said. As soon as we get Lindsay's screen back on, we'll keep moving.
That may be a minute. I'm having more severe difficulty this time around. If you have it on your screens, that may be the best mode to move forward.
Yeah, the next one is maternal death or serious disability associated with labor or delivery.
That happens.
In a low-risk pregnancy.
Happens a lot. Does this include employees and family members?
Yeah. It's right up there with those newborn abductions.
Can everybody follow along? Does everybody have a computer, an Excel spreadsheet on their computer, or a printout that we can continue?
Yeah.
Anybody not? Okay, so that's where we are. We're at maternal death with labor and delivery, and perhaps we can move right past this. All right, let's move on.
It's Peter. Let me just press the point, though.
Okay, good.
You guys know your facilities and your environments better, and I know it totally seems like it's irrelevant, but are there facilities that have young enough women that would become pregnant?
What about a mental health facility? That is a good point. Would it be enough that would... It would include it, though?
I don't think so. I really don't.
Well, I would question whether or not that would be considered low risk if somebody is already institutionalized in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would think that in and of itself would take it away from the low risk.
Right.
And once again, the submission did not include skilled nursing facilities to be added.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're comfortable with it, I just wanted to press the point, make sure we just didn't blow by and oversee something, but that's fine.
All right, so the next one is death or serious disability with kernicterus and hyperbilirubinemia and neonates.
No. Hypoglycemia.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're right. Hypoglycemia. Let's take that one on.
Well, that one's
big.
Important.
Big.
Now, there were a number of issues on some of the suggested changes. Again, this one caught my attention with regards to infants and children. And again, not to make the parallel, but we have a lot of elderly patients that have lost body mass and have much more difficulty auto-regulating their insulin requirements as we move forward. A much more difficult time at the end of life. Do we need some language in the suggested modifications as well?
I had a question about that later. Would this include like a palliative care type patient or a hospice patient?
And I think that palliative care question comes up with pressure ulcers as well.
Pressure ulcers, right, that's where.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and so going from what some of the previous implementation guidance has, to be able to include that language that says this is not intended to cover situations where the residents are under hospice or in palliative care. Or, I mean, we could put that kind of language in there, but I guess the thing that I guess the concern is that we should really be paying close attention to erring more on the side of allowing patients to have a higher blood sugar than this low blood sugar. And maybe the discussion is really around, you know, at what level, at where should we be expressing our concern about the processes that are in place. It seems to me, anyway, that what we would be gearing towards is having blood sugars that aren't so low in any circumstance. I don't know.
No, you're expressing yourself fine. And again, it's the richness of the discussion that's most important here.
And the area where I think it would be very pertinent to our environment is many times I've certainly encountered, maybe all of you too, patients with blood sugars of 45 or 50 and they're on their early morning check, and the nurses are attempting to feed them to get it up instead of giving them glucagon.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that brings up the issue of a blood sugar of 45 or 50, and they're alert and talking and not having any problems.
Well, this is for death and disability related to
hypoglycemic
event.
If they're not rescued. It's a failure to rescue.
It's a failure. That's what this is, yes.
Right.
All right. So no suggested language modifications. The interpretive guidelines seem to be okay.
Now, Eric, this is Jim. I've got something scratching about in my head. I have a level of discomfort with this, but
yes.
I cannot express what it is.
Is it that terminal patient? And if it's a terminal patient, why are they still getting, you know, tight monitoring of their, you know, of their blood sugars, right?
No, I agree, and I think that we should, Eric, have something in here in this implementation guidance that says this is not intended to cover patients who are receiving terminal care. I mean, I think that because obviously if they are in a situation where they are in hospice or we're providing comfort measures only, and they die because their blood sugar was 45, you know, for whatever the reason, they're not eating or who knows. But but the point is that we shouldn't, I think that should be taken out of here.
Right. And I think that helps alleviate any ambiguity.
I agree with that.
Okay. Peter, comfortable with the discussion?
I'm good. You guys
all right? I'm good with it too.
The only question, the only point I want to make about the issue with comfort measures only palliative care, terminal care, is that many of the clients in long-term care may fit that category. I mean, they come to a nursing home to die, so we don't want to downplay the treatment that we're providing them as well, and giving nursing homes a loophole for not treating them. So I think we have to be cautious on how we define those.
Yeah, and Peter, we probably will have to take extra time because, you know, the argument goes, can there ever be an unexpected death in the nursing home?
Right.
So
definition for the end life of care, because we know that many times that term is used rather loosely in the nursing home, and they put people in there that really need to be given care.
Correct.
So I just want to make sure we're tight on that.
No, and I think that's the point. The argument is that there are unexpected deaths in the nursing home.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, it would seem to me, in most situations, and even in a palliative care situation, the tendency should be to under-medicate, not over-medicate. So, you know, your comment earlier about having tight control on a patient that's under hospice or end-of-life care is, you know, silly.
It's silly, right.
Yeah.
Eric, this is Jim. Maybe this will help me saying it out loud. Two things. Number one, back to the serious disability, and should we acknowledge that many of these folks already have serious disabilities, and do you mean in addition to those, number one? And number two, perhaps under preventability, that is, what about the dementia patient where it is so difficult to determine what their clinical status is, if not impossible, and may not want to submit to having a finger stick blood sugar done? I'm not sure I'm expressing myself well, but there's just something that bothers me that I can't elucidate. I'm sorry.
Well, I think it gets to that autonomy question again and quality of life issues as they relate to our patient population. But I think the thrust is that hypoglycemia is not where we're moving. Tight control, we're saying that that's not the way to go today in our nursing home and skilled care environment.
Agreed.
I do think that Jim, though, has hit upon a point that makes it difficult, and that is for those residents that not only refuse to have, you know, they really don't, they refuse finger stick blood sugars, they refuse all lab work, and you were giving them medications that, you know, maybe we're still trying to keep it low, but then all of a sudden, if they stop eating, how do you monitor?
Right.
And I think there should be some caveat. I agree with that.
Right. Good enough. Good. All right, let's move on. Anybody want to talk about Kernicterus?
I actually had a case with that, but okay.
I think we're going to let that one go. We've got a lot to do on the next one to deal with.
Hospital, though.
All right. Let's take on the stage four pressure ulcers. Again, let me start this discussion. I'm not sure where we go with palliative care. We talked about this at the steering committee. I really worry that sometimes we put people on palliative care because they've developed an ulcer, and it's our free pass out of it. Yet, this is such... I don't know where this one sorts out. I'm really not convinced where we draw the line, where we say this shouldn't have happened or this does happen. I mean, it happens, and it happens frequently. And I actually worry about our well-being with regards to this one and with regards to falls. We need to get this right.
We're not going to.
All right. Go ahead. Add some more.
Well, I think if we stick with federal regulations, I mean, that certainly is the falls and stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcers acquired in a facility fits with what the regulations are. So I don't know if we want to if we want to follow what the federal regulations say in this area to, I guess, avoid confusion. Just one idea.
How about solving world peace? That might be easier than this.
Well, you know, even the steering committee passed off to the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory saying we were waiting for their guidance to come out.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there's some language here for that, right?
Yeah, there is.
I'm sorry, this is Deb. I got disconnected, so I apologize, but I didn't hear.
Are there any ideas in the summary of suggested modifications that would help us?
Deb, we're on stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcers, and it's such a conundrum for us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they said define the NPUAP.
Yeah.
Well, and the issue for me, I apologize because I didn't hear the previous discussion, is we're saying stage 3 or 4, but we also have that deep tissue injury, and I don't know if that got brought up at all.
I was going to mention that, too, because that's a big concern, we know.
Well, we're having more and more issues around that, and in many ways it's as serious or more serious than the stage 3 or 4
right.
pressure ulcers that we know about.
How would you define a deep tissue injury?
Well, the NPUAP defines deep tissue injury.
Okay.
The issue is, in their new definitions, it's well defined, but the issue is that it's as serious, I think, as the stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcers, and it's not included here.
What? There was some language in some of the suggested ones. Where that was.
Eric, this is Jim. With no answers in hand, I think at least in our discussion we have to talk about a couple of things, and one is the stageable versus unstageable. Number 2, avoidable versus unavoidable. And number 3, the fact that the appropriate diagnosis of a pressure ulcer versus an arterial ulcer versus a venous stasis ulcer, et cetera, are all serious problems and will have to be part of the modification of this. Unfortunately, I'm not wise enough to tell you what those should be.
This event just doesn't have it just can't be pulled as easily from the hospital setting to the nursing home population. The populations are significantly different.
But Eric, how do we deal with the issue that we, receive a patient from the hospital in the nursing home, where the injury started in the hospital? They were laying in a surgical table for 5 hours without moving,
right.
And now we have them in the nursing home doing post-op care because of this deep tissue injury. And in the if you look under the summary of suggested modifications, there's some suggestion in here to exclude deep tissue injury.
Right.
And that concerns me a lot.
Right.
So isn't the point, though, not to say the source of it, but where it's recognized and that it should be reported as such once it's recognized?
Right, but I wouldn't exclude it.
I wouldn't exclude it either.
Yeah.
Now, this is Peter. Are there two separate issues here? One is new ulcers that progress rapidly after the patient
is
admitted versus those types of patients who arrive with the ulcers from other facilities.
I think this is, what's written